KZSU Stanford. And today I'm joined by author and so much more from his home in Northern California, Mr. Derek Jensen. Derek, you on the line with us?
Yeah.
Derek Jensen, you're an author, a radical activist, environmentalist, a lecturer, a philosopher, and an educator, and much, much more, an author of over 20 books. And so, the list is pretty long, but just a few: Walking on Water, Strangely Like War, The Culture of Make-Believe, Listening to the Land, Railroads and Clear Cuts, A Language Older Than Words, Deep Green Resistance, Endgame Volume 1 and Volume 2, What We Leave Behind, and even more than that, you're the winner of the Eric Hoffer Book Award, the USA Today's Critics' Choice, and the Press Action's Person of the Year 2005. I know there's more, but welcome to KZSU.
Thanks again for having me.
Thank you for your time. I know you're busy. You're probably working on a book right now. Am I wrong?
I'm just trying to think if it's one book or two books right now. I'm working on a book. I just finished another essay for Orion, and then I got asked to do a short essay for a English language newspaper out of India. That's something that actually kind of surprises me. Two things surprised me about becoming a writer. One is that I always thought that I never knew how much sort of secondary writing there was. I thought you just sit around and write your books, but it ends up that there's lots of smaller things that one does too. And the other thing is, I always thought that you'd sit around in your bathrobe all day and write, but the truth is, I travel a lot and do a lot of I'm glad that I've got all these books out. It makes me happy, and at the same time, and I've heard this from other writers too, it's like, where does the time go? You know, I used to have a lot more time to write when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. I guess
that's what all old people say, isn't it? You know? Like, where'd the time go? Where'd I have time to go to a movie or something?
Do you get a lot of requests for those other projects besides your books? You said, you know, there's all these other little side projects of writing. Are those publications that ask you to write for them?
Yeah, I get that a lot, and I have to turn a lot of them down. I just don't have time. And then also, a lot of interview requests and mm-hmm. and
I know you speak a lot too. You got a lot of YouTube appearances out there, and I've been watching a few the last few days. And you stay pretty busy that way, don't you?
Yeah. And, you know, that's all pretty interesting, too. I mean, this has nothing to do with my larger work, but I enjoy doing the talks themselves, but I just hate traveling so much.
Yeah.
And you and I talked beforehand about you've talked to a lot of blues players, and, I don't understand how so many musicians do it, where they tour as much as they do.
Well, that's how you have to make a living. It's funny though. I'd like to use that as a kind of a setup, because your position in your work is about the dominant culture and what it's doing to the planet, and it's got to be a little tough for you when you have to hop on an airplane or drive in a car, because that kind of goes against what you're about, right?
Well, that's actually not so important, because there's a great line by a friend of mine, the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and dismantle those systems of oppressive authority.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually worry. I think one of the big problems with environmentalism, one of the big dead ends we've gone down, is down this whole personal purity lifestyle direction, that it's pretty harmful. And the reason it's harmful is because what happens is people end up substituting personal action for organized political resistance. But personal change does not equal social change. And so I could never drive a car again, or I could never fly in an airplane, and that actually wouldn't stop the oil economy. What we need to do is to organize to stop the oil. And a way to think about this is that, would personal purity have stopped Hitler? You know, would individuals biking to work have stopped Hitler, or would it have stopped apartheid for people to compost or to take shorter showers? And one more thing about this is that the numbers make clear that it's not really, that's not really where the real action is that I wrote an essay called Forget Shorter Showers years ago, and part of that was just running the numbers on this, that 90% of the water used by anything associated with human beings at all is used by agriculture and industry. 90% is used by agriculture and industry. And the same amount of water is used by municipal humans as is used by municipal golf courses. So really, you know, if you're going to take shorter showers, that's just going to ruin your social life. But if you really want to save water for the fish, for the rivers, then what you need to do is to stop agriculture and industry. And the same thing is true with waste, that I could reduce my waste. The average person in the United States produces about 2,600 pounds or something like that of waste per year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could reduce that to zero by recycling everything, by not buying anything with packaging, et cetera, et cetera. But the bad news is that if I do that, the actual per capita production of trash in the United States is about 26 tons because of agriculture and industry again. 97% is produced by agriculture and industry. So all these movies like An Inconvenient Truth, you know, they do a great job of laying out, it's so frustrating, they do a great job of laying out the problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, basically the world's being killed by global warming, or Food, Inc., talking about the, we'll talk about that in a second. So An Inconvenient Truth, he gets to the end, and then all the solutions he presents are personal, and he doesn't talk about corporate power, he doesn't talk about the growth economy. And if every single person in the United States did every single thing that Al Gore suggested, it would only reduce carbon emissions by 20%, 22%.
Why do you think it was like that? Why do you think he did that? He didn't do that.
Well, and that's, I think it's because, partly because we've been conned down this direction of thinking that personal change does equal social change. And so that's where a lot of people immediately go. How can I be green? Well, it's by buying recycled paper towels, as opposed to organized political resistance. And then there's the other question is, who actually benefits from this then? I think that it ends up being sort of an act of prestidigitation, really, of misdirection, where those in power have to acknowledge that something is wrong, because everybody recognizes there are many, many things wrong. Like Food, Inc. was the same way, that there is clearly, I mean, the movie does a great job of laying out that the food production system is incredibly exploitative, incredibly harmful, and incredibly anti-democratic. And then their solution is to do things like buy yogurt from Walmart. So my point is that they do have to at some point acknowledge that there's a problem. But then if they can slide off, you know, if they can... they can say, okay, there's a problem, and then provide a useless solution, then the problem has still been laid out, and they can buy more time. And I'm not saying this in terms of a conspiracy. There's not six people who are conspiring about this. What it is, instead, is that it's like a friend of mine says, that you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same.
Yeah, that's true.
And so we have... another way to talk about this is to talk about the great line by Upton Sinclair, which is, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And we can talk about this in terms of the not just people's individual jobs, but the larger culture, that it's hard to make people understand something when their way of life is depends on them not understanding it.
That's one of the things I wanted to...
entitlement depends on them not understanding it.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I wanted to touch on, too. We're talking to Derek Jensen, author, radical activist, so much more, written over 20 books, and now he lectures all over the United States, at least, if not farther on. Was just down speaking at Occupy Oakland and San Francisco, spoke at Occupy Seattle, spoke at Occupy D.C., you've got a long history going back to, you've done a lot of different stuff. You taught at Pelican Bay, creative writing. You were a beekeeper at one point. You're not just some cat that came out of the classroom and just started reading writing. And one of your books turned into an organization, Deep Green Resistance, that I want to touch on some point in this next in best part of this hour. But what brought you to all this, Derek? What you started out, you were in school. You were studying to be an engineer, and you also went to up in Washington. You studied creative writing. What brought you to the point where you are one of the foremost radical environmental activist authors in the country? What brought you to that?
Well, there's a bunch of threads that we can mention very, very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that when I was in second grade, so I was about 7 or 8, somebody put in a subdivision right next to where I lived, and that had previously been a meadow and prairie. And
you saw a change.
I saw a change, and I didn't have the language. Well, the language I had at the time was that they can't keep doing this forever, because if you build something like that, you're building on someone's home. And if they keep doing this, they're going to run out of space. And so that's the language I did have. And the language I didn't have at the time is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. So there's that thread began when I was a child. Another thread that began when I was a child is that my father's extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me.
Ooh.
And even as a kid, I was asking the question, if his behavior isn't making him happy — I didn't use the word behavior because I was 6 years old — but if what he's doing isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And so that's another thread that really started then, is just asking, why do people do these incredibly destructive things?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was a teenager, I was raised a fundamentalist Christian, and I was still very right-wing when I was a kid. And,
really?
Yeah. In fact, when I was 15, 1976, they did a, in ninth grade, they did a, they asked us to write something for the U.S. Bicentennial, and I wrote this little essay about, at school, and I wrote this little essay about how we had failed our brave allies in South Vietnam, and we had to nuke all the commies.
Wow. Has anybody ever brought...
Yeah, a little ways. And, I mean, in 1980, this is one of the things I talk about sometimes, it's kind of embarrassing, one of the most embarrassing things I did in my life. When I was 19, I voted for Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And if he would have won by one vote, then I would just kill myself.
Has that writing ever come back to you? Has anybody ever brought that back at you, like some try to scandalize you and said, look what you wrote when you were 16? I mean, you cop to it, but has anybody...
No, in part because I acknowledge it freely.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So it can't hurt you, but...
I mean, it shows really that at least some people can change.
Right.
I'm a kid, you know? It's like, I mean, do you really want to be held accountable for what you did when you're 15?
No.
You know, I mean, when we're 15, we're by definition immature.
Anyway,
so one of the things that happened then also is that I heard my older brother introduced me to rock and roll, and I heard the Bachman-Turner Overdrive song, Taking Care of Business.
Mm-hmm.
You get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 to the city, and there's a whistle up above, and people pushing, people shoving, all the girls trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9, you start your slave job and get your pay. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed, I love to work at nothing all day. And
you really paid attention to those lyrics, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. And up until then, I was this good little capitalist, and this is just an example of how art can really change your life. I mean, I don't. We could probably quibble over Bachman-Turner Overdrive and art, but we'll leave that aside. because for the first time, I questioned the wage economy, and I started asking people all through college. I was pretty unhappy when I went to college. I did what most people who are pretty good at math and science do, or a lot of people who are good at math and science do, which is I went to an engineering school. I got a scholarship. And I couldn't afford to go elsewhere, so I got a scholarship to Colorado School of Mines, one of the best engineering schools in the country. And I hated it. I absolutely hated being there. And I started asking people, just random people, you know, bus drivers, ticket takers at a concert, or people at a grocery store, anything. I started asking all these people if they liked their jobs. And about 90% would say no. And I started asking, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I started asking my fellow students if they liked being at the School of Mines, and most of them didn't. Most of them hated it. But what they said is, when I get out of here, I'm going to get a good job, and I'm going to make a lot of money. And then when I retire, I'm going to blah, blah, blah. And so, I mean, there's 20-year-olds who are talking about what they're going to do when they retire. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. I mean, I only have one life that I know of, and I don't want to spend it doing things I don't want to do. And so, okay, that's another thread.
That was kind of the American dream that we were all taught, or kind of a path led down, though, by our parents, wasn't it?
Oh, exactly.
You know, go to school. And that the Occupy is kind of a reaction to, they got lied to. These kids got lied to because they were told that same thing. And now that they're out of school and they're all in debt, they're going, wait a minute, this doesn't work.
Well, and it works even less for them than it would have for me, because mm-hmm. at least in my case, back in the early 80s, the American dream / nightmare would, at least I would have gotten a job, you know?
Yeah.
That part of the so-called dream would have worked.
Now, did you get a job? Sorry to interrupt, but did you go on to get a job, or did you just start writing right away?
Well, I worked all through college at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and that was also pretty eye-opening for me, too, in a sense, because I would ask my bosses there if they liked their jobs, and actually most of them did. And I remember one day that one of my bosses called in sick, and then he showed up a couple hours later, and he said, I just couldn't bear to miss the experiments we were doing today. And this really struck me because I would call in sick if it's a nice day. It's like, hey, I'm sick of work, you know? And I realized that never again would I choose to do anything for which I wouldn't do it even if I called in sick, you know? It's like, I wouldn't do anything for which that I didn't want. I wasn't going to live my life according to pay, where I'm going to go do a job because I have to. What I wanted to do is to find something I would do that I would love. And meanwhile, through college, I had bought a couple beehives, and I really loved working with bees. And so I went into debt to, so that's the American way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I went into debt to become a commercial beekeeper because I knew I had to pay the rent. You know, we live in a capitalist system, and we need to function within it. There are some people who believe that simply because one is an artist that one can live on the beauty of one's words alone. But sorry, you know, we all got to pay rent.
I saw a great description that you did in one of your talks about the situation of rent, where you said, well, wait a minute, let's reverse engineer that. Well, what happens if you don't? And you don't need to go into all of it. It was a great talk, though. It was a great take on that rent thing.
Well, thanks. And what that is, basically, is, once again, showing how crazy the system is. Now, the system itself is based on violence. I'll go through that really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a talk one time, and there was this guy said, you know, you talk about this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. I don't see violence anywhere in my life. And I said, so do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. And I said, why? And he said, well, because I don't own. And I said, no, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, well, I would get evicted. And I said, what's that look like? And he said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. And I said, stop right there. What happens if the sheriff comes to your house and you invite him in for dinner and you have dinner, and then at the end of dinner you say, you know, this is my house, so you should leave now? And he said, well, he'd take out his gun and he'd say, you didn't pay your rent, so I'm here to evict you. And I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, somebody with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your house.
That's violence.
Yeah, and that's violence. And part of the reason we don't recognize a lot of the violence of the system is because we're so deeply metabolized into it. We accept the notion that we're supposed to pay rent, or that we accept the notion that we're supposed to pay for food. And we're not paying the local farmer. I have no problem paying a local farmer for their work. I got no problem with that. But I got to tell you, I really resent paying ADM or Cargill, or, you know, there's like, what, four companies control 90% of the grain market, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you're not paying, your neighbor. You're not helping your neighbor. You're not giving your neighbor something in kind for what they're providing for you. Instead, you're giving this monopoly money that you have to give or you die. It's so strange that we have to pay someone for the right to exist on the planet.
It's a discount.
And pay, by the way, this is a huge toxic mimic because we have to pay these corporations as opposed to what you're supposed to do, which is you're supposed to pay the land where you live. You're supposed to. The land supports you. The land feeds you, and you're supposed to pay it back.
This is the real gist of what this is the real gist.
You're supposed to feed it too. I'm sorry, what?
This is the real gist of what I've gotten out of your writings the last month or two. I've been reading that you're coming from the point of view that the way it was before modern culture and the dominant culture and the industrial civilization grew up. The way it was people lived off the land like the Native Americans, and they didn't have to worry about being sustainable because they lived as part of the land. They were part of the whole thing, and it wasn't them against the land or them against nature. They were part of nature.
I agree with all of that, except for the part about they didn't have to think about being sustainable. I think that they made conscious decisions to live within their means. And so they did actually worry about being sustainable by, like, among the, I've got a good friend who's a Dakota, and we talked about what would happen to someone who is a Dakota, 150 years ago, what would have happened to someone who was a Dakota person who killed bison when they weren't supposed to be killed. And the first time they would be said, they wouldn't think of it because you don't do it.
Comes natural.
But if they would have done it, then they would have said, don't ever do this. It's very bad.
Mm-hmm.
But if they would have done it again, they would have burned their teepee, destroyed their weapons, reduced them to complete beggary. So people would be socially disrewarded, socially harmed for committing acts that are against, that harm the community as a whole, including the land. And this is really important because the Talawa Indians, I live on Talawa land, and the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the stories of science. And if you believe the stories told by the Talawa, they've lived since the beginning of time. But either way, it was a long, long time.
Do they still live there?
12,000 years. So they were living here sustainably, and the place was an absolute paradise. And dominant culture has been here about 180 years, and the place is trashed. And, so back to my story. I want to finish up this real quickly, the story of how I got to where I am,
mm-hmm.
which is in my late 20s, I met a guy who was an environmentalist, and I knew that everything's messed up. And he really helped channel my energy into environmentalism and into protecting land. And there's a sentence he said that sort of ties everything together for me here, which is a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up, question the foundations of Western civilization.
Hmm.
And this is because once the questions start, they just keep spiderwebbing. Once somebody asks, why is this piece of land being destroyed? Then you ask, why is any piece of land being destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
And then you ask, why would you have a way of life that is destructive of land that is supporting you, that is the source of all life? And then you keep going back to the beginnings of this culture. And it's the same no matter really what questions you ask. That's why I brought up the thing about, okay, if you begin with asking about a wage economy, why is there a wage economy? If you ask that question seriously enough and then you go through, if you trust the answers, then why is there a wage economy starts leading to ask, why is there capitalism? Well, first off, let's not ask why there's a wage economy. First off, if you ask why so many people spend their lives doing things they don't want to do, that leads you to why is there a wage economy, which leads you to why is there capitalism, which leads you to, back and back to the origins of this culture. Same thing for women or men who ask why is there rape or why do men beat on women? Then if you ask those questions long enough, it's going to take you back to the core of patriarchy.
Kind of like pulling the thread on that sweater, that knitted sweater, and as soon as you pull that thread, the whole thing unravels.
Exactly. And, there's a review somebody did of one of my books years ago that was one of my favorite things anybody's ever said about my work, which is they said that I was, quote, almost pathologically unsentimental. And I really like that because it's not unemotional, not at all, but unsentimental. It's like the point is that I have attempted as best I can to follow wherever the questions lead. And
You just kept pulling the thread.
And how you can have, for example, so many, like this takes us back to the whole Al Gore question or whatever. I don't understand how you can have someone who understands global warming but then doesn't question the corporate economy. It makes no sense to me.
But his whole life, he's been part of that system, and maybe he just can't get away from it, you know?
Well, I totally hear you, and I don't disagree, but at the same time, you know, I was raised a fundamentalist Christian myself, you know, really right-wing. My father's pretty wealthy, not as wealthy as Al Gore's father, but, you know, pretty well off, and, you know, somehow I ended up questioning. So, you know, there's another interesting thing. I don't mean to make this the Al Gore hour, but I don't know if you remember this, but back in the 90s, there was this little bit of a scandal because some letters came out that Al Gore had written to his father back during the Vietnam War, when he was accusing the United States of being an imperialist power and giving, you know, a pretty decent sort of Chomsky-esque analysis of U.S. imperialism. And then Al Gore, of course, had to deny those letters and basically say the same thing about those letters that I said about my essay when I was 15, you know, that, wow, I was young and stupid.
Had to disavow it.
And it's just so interesting. I sometimes wonder, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, but I sometimes wonder if, you know, in a lot of these people, if in their hearts of hearts that they really do get this and they stop for political reasons, or, you know, thinking that he would lose credibility if he actually talked about these issues, or if the block is, if he actually doesn't take his analysis that far. And I ask this of, you know, a lot of sort of mainstream environmentalists too. It's like a lot of mainstream environmentalists are calling for like a switch to windmills, but windmills are an incredibly toxic process themselves. There are parts of China that are these absolute toxic messes because of the rare earth mining for them. And it's not that difficult to follow the logic back. I mean, if you have an electrical system, what this means is that you have to have, at the very least, wiring. And where do you get the metal for the wiring? Well, so that means if you have an electrical system, you have to have mining. Okay? And mining is incredibly toxic. So it's just following back. Or, you know, central to all of my analysis is the understanding industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. That's one of the premises of Endgame. I'm just appalled that more people don't understand this, because all I say is that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. I mean, duh. How smart do you have to be to figure that one out? That if you have a finite amount of something, you're going to use it up. And second, any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. And that's the same. You know, the rivers here were so full of salmon that they would keep people awake at night with the slapping of their tails against the water. They were so full of salmon that people were afraid to put their boats in water for fear they'd capsize.
Speak about the first settlers that, not settlers, but the first explorers that came into the San Francisco Bay in the ships they came into. What did they say about what the bay looked like? The first white men that showed up there. What did they say about the fish?
You tell me. The only thing I know about the San Francisco explorers, I know that the bay was wonderful, is that there were so many sea lions that it looked like the area was paved with sea lions.
Yeah, well,
the other thing I heard was that
even though they were in the ships and they came in the Golden Gate, the fish were so thick they said that they could actually get out of the ship and walk on the water because the fish were so thick in the bay.
Yeah, I've heard so many stories like that all over. That's what they said about sea turtles in the Gulf of Mexico.
Really? We're talking to Derek Jensen, author of many books. He's been called a radical activist, an environmentalist. He is a lecturer and a philosopher. You can see his website at derekjensen.org. He can also be heard the first Monday of every month on WOJB 88.9 FM at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And you can catch that if you're not on the West Coast at wojb.org. And it's a listener call-in show, so I think you can call in and talk to Derek. And, you know, radio time goes so fast, Derek, that I in reading your material the last month or so, there's some words that came up that you explain in your books, but I love the way you explain them, that I made a little short list of words, and it's almost like a Rorschach test I'd like to just try now. Would that be okay?
Oh, great.
So you just like I'll say a phrase. And
a longer response.
Yeah, well, I'll say a phrase, and you just respond to it, because I've seen you responded all these phrases in your book, like okay. Sustainable.
Something is sustainable if it can be done forever. And I would contrast that with sustainable TM, which is a marketing phrase, which is used for to make us think that things are sustainable but when they're not. But mm-hmm. for something to be sustainable, it has to be based on what the land will give. It has to be based, for something to be sustainable, it actually has to help the land base on its own terms. Mm-hmm. If you're actually harming your land base, it's not sustainable. Which means that what you take from the land base has to be what it gives willingly and what it can supply. So that the salmon don't decrease every year. There has to be the same number of salmon every year. And then your waste products have to be food for someone else, which means no plastic. My poop is eaten by slugs or by insects or by mushrooms. And that's the way it has to be. And because if you are providing a waste that is not someone else's food, obviously it's not going to be converted into something helpful for the land base.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about dominant culture?
Well, the dominant culture really began in the Near East about 6 or 10,000 years ago, and it's been destroying the planet ever since. It's one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hills of Iraq. Prior to the beginning of this culture, it was a cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground, and that's not what Iraq is anymore.
Mm-mm.
And the Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The big three dead Greek guys, Aristotle, Plato, and I think Sophocles, I never can remember, they all three complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And I'm guessing that they, when they complained about this, the whatever equivalent, the Greek Department of Environmental Quality told them that they needed to study this for another couple thousand years to make sure there's actually a connection.
if there was one back then.
Yeah.
How about industrial civilization?
It's something that brings comforts or elegancies, as one pro-slavery philosopher put in the 1830s, to a small number of people at tremendous expense to the entire planet. Industrial civilization is killing the planet. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. 99% of native prairies have been converted. 98% destroyed. 98% of native forests have been destroyed. And and it's functionally unsustainable. It's functionally and systematically unsustainable, and it's based on empire. It's based on theft from the colonies. So I guess if I were going to put one word to it, it would be kleptocracy.
Mm-hmm. How about land base?
It's the source of all life. And it's what's real. That's another part of the problem is that people have come to believe that this culture is what is real. I was doing this terrible radio interview with this guy out of Santa Barbara several years ago. I didn't know going into it, but I just said yes to doing an interview. And he was this right-wing property rights uber alles Bible thumper.
Mm.
And I was talking about how, you know, sharks are getting hammered, salmon are getting hammered, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, you know, migratory songbirds are getting hammered, those dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And he kept saying the same thing back to me, which is, Derek, that's all fine, but let's get back in the real world. I thought I was talking about the real world.
Yeah,
what I
right.
realized is that when he says real world, what he's talking about is sort of real politic. What he's talking about is industrial capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people like students at college will say to each other, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what that means is, what are you going to do when you get out and have to get a job?
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem, is that people have gotten confused over what's the real world. The real world is not the stock market. The real world is not the crab season is being delayed here in Del Norte, where I live, because the crabs just don't have, they're skinny. they don't have much meat on them.
Until they've been overfished.
Yeah, yeah. Well, by saying that, you have guaranteed that you will never be in charge of the crab season, won't you?
Mm-hmm.
And the position as harbor master.
And the abalones, too. Abalones in California used to be you could go out just a little ways and get abalones. And what I've noticed now is abalones that are gotten now, the shells are that much smaller. They keep getting smaller and smaller because every year they go out and get them, they're not allowing them to grow long enough.
Yep, yep. And what people consider the real world is the economic, you know, the economic system. And mm-hmm. that's not the real world. It's like, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming that are put forward by the mainstream have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given. And the real world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. That's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Because I hate to break the news to them, but without a real world, you don't have any economic or social system whatsoever. So if you want to have a social system and a livable planet, you have to make your social system conform to the real world. The real world's primary, and that's what so many people have forgotten.
Now, on this day after the weekend where they supposedly finished those talks down in Durban, South Africa, about what they're going to do about global warming, what would be the solution, in your opinion, Derek Jensen, to meeting the challenge of global warming against mankind? What could mankind do right now, starting today, to help combat global warming from taking him out, or global climate change, or whatever you want to call it, from taking man off the picture?
Well, first off, I think that there is more to this planet than simply humans.
Okay.
And my concern is for the salmon and the migratory songbirds and the bats and the oceans. And
mm-hmm.
And so I'm not actually so concerned about it taking humans out of the picture. I mean, for crying out loud, there's more than 7 billion humans right now, and there's, between 40 and 60 Javan rhinos left? So actually I'm more concerned about the ones who are actually in danger right now. And second, if you ask any reasonably intelligent 7 or 8-year-old how you stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they will tell you to stop burning oil and gas. So that's the first thing. Is, you know, that's part that's central to my work too, is the notion that we are not going to undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, every cell in my body wants for that. And we could have a gradual descent. We could have a sort of soft landing without much trouble. And all that would have to happen is capitalism, the free market does not exist. Capitalism is entirely based on subsidies. And so all you'd have to do is convert the subsidies and make it so. I just read last night that the United States, it essentially costs $400 per gallon of gas that they deliver to troops in Afghanistan. And
that's unsustainable.
Yeah, that's unsustainable even on the level of any sort of government spending.
Well, not for Halliburton, though, because they're the ones getting paid the $400.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Here's the thing is, okay, even when I was this little right-wing, you know, fanatic, when I was a teenager, I actually thought that the whole Vietnam War thing was really stupid in some ways because, I mean, forget the injustice and forget, you know, murdering millions of people in Vietnam and forget invading, forget all that stuff. It also was just really stupid because I read somewhere when I was a kid that it cost about $500,000 to kill each Vietnamese person that the United States killed. That's how much they spent on the military to kill each person.
What a statistic.
I'm sorry?
What a statistic.
Yeah, and so I remember thinking as a kid, and let's say I'm off. I mean, I don't remember. You know, it's a long time ago. Maybe it's $50,000. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's a lot of money. And this is in a country with a per capita income at that point of, you know, I don't know, I'm making this up too. Maybe it was $500 a year. But the point is, and probably less, the point is that even when I was a kid, if, you know, the dirty commies would have paid me, and instead of killing them, why don't you give them half of that money and say, hey, be our friend?
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a much more economical way to affect some sort of change. So right now, instead of, same sort of deal, instead of paying $400 a gallon, and, you know, who knows how much money in total to I actually did the math on this a couple years ago with how much the military invasion of Afghanistan was costing, and then I contrasted. I looked up. You know, this is the cool thing about being a writer is you get to look up all sorts of strange things and have an excuse to do so. I looked up how much a hitman costs. And it actually would have been cheaper if the United States wanted to depopulate Afghanistan. It would have been cheaper to hire mafia hitmen to actually kill them individually than to send in the military. And I'm not saying that's okay. I mean, this is all just horrible. And my point is actually, instead, just hand them some money to make some schools and to make some hospitals and to reforest. How's that? And my point is that we could have. Here's another part of this. Is that I wrote about this in the Culture Make Believe that back in 1972 or something, George McGovern, liberal senator, was talking to someone at I think Rockwell International, the company that was doing I think the B-1 bomber, and he said to the CEO, "So if we could get you money, I mean you don't care what you make, right? If we could get you the money to make school buses instead of bombers, you would do that, right?" And the guy said, "Of course we would." And then they both just laughed because they knew they could never get it through the House and Senate to actually build school buses instead of bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And my point on all this is that we could have changed the subsidies and use the money that is being spent on the military to... okay, here's one thing. Is if you, in the United States, if you converted all of the prairie east of the Mississippi back to prairie, it would immediately make the United States a carbon sink. And that's without getting rid of industrialization.
In a carbon sink, meaning soaking up the carbon that's actually causing global warming.
Because prairies soak up tremendous amounts of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a technical thing that could be done. It's like years ago, Richard Branson, I think his name is, the guy who does Virgin Airlines,
yeah,
put out this thing where he was going to give somebody like $1 million if they could come up with something that would store up carbon. It was, you know, make some sort of carbon sink.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so tempted to write to him and say, here's my solution, trees. You know, here's the address where you can send the check. Because he wanted to make some sort of technical thing. But rehabilitation of land is something that can be done immediately. That's very, very, that's something that makes carbon sinks immediately.
So if there's somebody listening to us right now and that was wondering how could I help make a change, but going beyond not using plastic bags anymore, would restoring land be a help?
It's a help, but we also have to remember that even with that, the problem is that there's not going to be a voluntary transformation,
mm-hmm.
and this culture is insane, and it is destroying the planet, and this is a whole subject for a whole other talk if you ever want to do it. But
I do.
But it's driven by this imperative to violate, and so what really needs to happen is there's basically, you asked what we could do right now, and
mm-hmm.
one of the things we could do right now would be the things I said, but those aren't going to happen. And so what ends up being one of the ways I look at this is, let's pretend we're asking the same question, except instead of it being industrial civilization that's killing the planet, instead space aliens had invaded.
Mm-hmm.
And they were destroying the planet. They're vacuuming the oceans. They're cutting down the forests. They are changing the climate and probably going to make the planet uninhabitable for humans, including for humans, much of it uninhabitable. They're putting docks in every mother's breast milk. What would we do? We would know exactly what to do. We would dismantle the infrastructure.
Yeah, we'd go
and
to war with them.
That's what those of us who care about life on this planet have to do, is we need to dismantle the industrial infrastructure.
Derek Jensen is the guest right now, author and radical environmentalist. And Derek, man, there's so much to talk about and so little time. And you know what? I loved your offer, too. I do want to do this again. And we still have 10 more minutes, so I want to keep this up. There's some more words I wrote down that might help. Just man, this is there's so many, but occupation. Now you recently spoke at three of the occupations, if not more. I saw YouTubes from D.C., Seattle, San Francisco, and Oakland. Actually, that's four. And that word occupation has a dual meaning in the United States, because we're on occupied land here. We occupy other countries in all kind of different ways. But this occupation, and I call them kids too often. They're not kids. The modern-day occupation of the protesters all around the country are from all different stripes of life. And does that give you hope? Is that a step in the right direction? Because you've been there and you've talked to them. What have you found?
Well, I think that I am delighted that there are people who are standing up on their hind legs and saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And I am delighted that there are people who are highlighting the fact that we don't live in a democracy. That, you know, I ask people all over the country, do you believe we live in a democracy? And nobody ever says yes. I mean, it's a joke, you know?
Yeah.
I say, do you believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? And everybody says corporations. But we continue to act as though we live in a democracy. You know, basically then what we do is we recognize we don't live in a democracy, but then we stop and we still pretend that we're going to beg the capitalist in chief to do what the capitalist in chief to do something against capital. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I'm so delighted that people are standing up. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful first step. And I think that my hope is that it is the beginnings of a movement that will coalesce into a serious resistance movement. And then you did mention the Occupy thing, and I do like to mention this whenever I wish they would change their name. And the reason I wish that is because Occupy, this country is occupied by a government of occupation. I mean, and my American Indian friends say, what took you so long to figure this one out? I mean, what a government of occupation does is it moves in, it facilitates resource extraction, maximizes production. That's what they do. And that's what the United States government does. It's like I saw this bumper sticker the other day I really like, which is U.S. out of North America. And and American Indians, a lot have been very offended. A lot of the ones I've spoken with have been very offended by the use of Occupy here, in part because they have been under occupation for 500 years. And when we think about World War II, you think about occupied France or occupied Russia or occupied Poland or...
Yeah, it's got a real dual meaning, more than dual.
Connotation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, there's so many other words that I wish they would choose. You know, decolonize, liberate. How about that? Liberate Oakland. Free Oakland. You know, whatever. You know,
have any
anyway,
of the...
So I have a concern about the word, but that's really a quibble, and I'm not complaining about that with a capital C, because, once again, they're actually doing something. I'm so delighted when someone is actually speaking out against the plutocracy.
Mm-hmm. Have any of the Native Americans showed up at Occupy to mention that to them? Because you in one of your talks, you recently at one of the Occupies, I think it was at Oakland, you mentioned the problem of rape, and they were having a problem of rape seriously in New York, and you kind of shamed them, and you said, "Hey, you know, you guys need to stand up for this, and this cannot happen here. And if it does, then you guys are all hypocrites." I'm not quoting you directly, but that's the gist I got from what you said. But if the Native Americans were to show up to Occupy and have an honest talk with these with these folks at the Occupies, for lack of a better word, you think that might help?
Well, my friend Waz, a Dakota activist, was there at Occupy Oakland, and she talked about the same thing. I mean, she talked about the word Occupy, and
mm-hmm.
she talked about a bunch of other things, too. And I don't know if it made any difference. But, yeah, I think it's a really important dialogue to have. And then so far as the rape, yeah, I'd heard about a fair number of rapes happening at various Occupies, and the response by the Occupy movement to that was pretty bad, in that they did not categorically take the side of the victims. And in some cases, in Baltimore, I believe it was, they actually put out a communique saying that basically attempting to dissuade women from reporting the rapes to the police, because that would embarrass the movement. And that's just nuts and
that's
terrible, because what embarrasses the movement and does more than embarrass the movement are the rapes themselves.
Yes.
And it's not the reporting. And that's another thing, is that when I said something about, I said at the Occupy Oakland, and I recognize that the cops are tools of the system, But that doesn't alter the fact that, and what I said there is, you know, if you, as a movement, are not going to take care of the rapists in a way that needs to, that they need to be taken care of, then you need to call the cops. And
yes.
for once, let them do their jobs. I mean, they tell us that they're here to protect us from sociopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of their jobs, but unfortunately, they only protect us from, when they do at all, they only protect us from poor sociopaths. They don't protect us from rich sociopaths. And one of the jokes I tell about this is two riddles aren't very funny. What do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, or at least relief 2026. On the other hand, what do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide.
I don't mean to laugh at that either.
What he got for murdering the Gulf of Mexico and murdering human beings in the Gulf of Mexico is a retirement package worth, $1 million a year plus 37 million shares of BP or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those, the cops don't, and this is something I said to the cops when I was there. It's like, why don't you protect people from those who are poisoning their land? And of course they're not going to.
Right.
So what we need to do as a people is we need to form militia units, frankly. We need to form militia units who will say, we're going to have a rape-free zone. We are going to have a cancer-free zone. We are going to enforce a clear-cut-free zone. We're going to enforce, we're not going to allow you, we're going to enforce a toxic dump-free site, a free zone. It's like years ago, I was doing a benefit for this community organization in New Mexico that was attempting to prevent a toxic dump from going into a neighborhood that was poor people and people of color. And they said that a lot of the cops who were arresting them during the protests were actually their neighbors. But when they put on the uniform, then they become the agents of the state and not agents of their community.
Sounds like this.
I started saying, well, how would it be if instead the cops actually were not enforcing the dictates of distant economic institutions, but instead the cops are enforcing not allowing anybody to poison you in your own community.
Mm-hmm.
And we all laugh because, of course, the cops aren't going to do that. So then we said, okay, what would it look like if you and your community organized to make sure that no one's going to put in a toxic waste dump? And I guess what that looks like is revolution, doesn't it?
Derek Jensen, we're out of time right now. Can we continue this conversation?
Sure. Sure, let's do another day.
Yes, let's do it. I'll be in touch on that. I want to thank you for all your work. You can catch Derek at derekjensen.org. You can catch him on the radio at wojb.org the first Monday of every month at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Derek, keep it up. I'll be in touch, and take care.
Okay, thanks. You too.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. That was Derek Jensen, the author, and we'll have him on again. Stand by for Holt and Electronic Groove right here on KZSU Stanford.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Mercy, mercy. All things and what they used to be oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby by us die. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?